You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 6th of April 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Studio One at Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Gillian DeBias.
And coming up on today's programme...
Let's cause some trouble now.
Break, break, bitches!
What are we supposed to do? Stop or struggle to continuously adjust to each other up to the end, even if we are out of tune?
From the psychedelic romp of Spring Breakers to the tragedy of Parkinson's explored in a late quartet, we'll be reviewing some new film releases with critic Alex Godfrey and David Jenkins.
We'll also meet the man who decided that being a successful restaurateur wasn't enough. He's now on a mission to re-release hard-to-find Peruvian classics in today's music review.
And we'll be welcoming back Susan Curtis-Koyakovich, director of Istros Books, to talk about new writing from Turkey and Romania.
So lots to look forward to this week on The Review here on Monocle 24. So hello and welcome one and all to Studio One here at Midori House. Gillian, it's been quite a week here, hasn't it?
I know. Have you survived the clothes?
the magazine, the May issue? Yes, it was the May issue. Yeah, has just gone to print. I say just gone to print. Tyler is still upstairs, reading the final pages. So we've pretty much sent May to print.
It seemed calm. This month, was it?
It seemed ish. But it's been quite a busy week as well, because not only that has been happening, but we've also been working on the book with Gestalten, and perhaps more importantly, or sort of more imminently, so to speak, we've got a little cafe opening very soon, haven't we?
I know, and we have a soft opening, which is much more fun, because it's you go to get your coffee because staff are allowed, and then you see all the other people who've sort of heard about it. They're in the know, and they all look very much like Monocle readers. It's a bit like central casting.
When we opened for a day last Monday at 7 a.m. There was apparently a queue outside at 6:55 of people who'd heard that it was opening and had decided they were going to get there.
It is faithful followers. But I have to say, though, it is such a nice addition to the neighbourhood. I mean, just beautiful wood and great illustrations, and then matched by fantastic made coffee and pastries.
It really is. It's on Chilton Street here in Marylebone. It opens officially on the 15th, but as Gillian says, it's sort of a soft opening at the moment, so I'm sure if you pop down, it will be there. You're listening to Review on Monocle 24.
And we start the show this week with film and a range of new releases that cover everything from Parkinson's to psychopathy. Joining us this week is film critic Alex Godfrey and David Jenkins, editor of Little White Lies magazine. Welcome to you both.
Hello.
Hi there.
We're going to kick things off with Harmony Korine's energetic and colourful crime thriller, Spring Breakers. Before we talk about it, let's have a little listen.
Come on, y'all. Why acting suspicious?
I knew y'all was special from the moment I saw you. It's written on your faces.
Because I just have a really, really bad feeling about this.
Let's cause some trouble now.
Break, break, bitches!
A little flavour of Spring Breakers there. Alex, to start with, give us a brief synopsis. brief.
Yeah, this is debauchery by the guy who has made a career out of focusing on very weird outsiders from the fringes of America. But this is his least weird film. Harmony Korine wrote Kids for Larry Clark, which was great, and then he's directed all sorts of terrible things since then. But this is the most successful, most mainstream thing he's done. It's about four young girls who want to go and have their spring break week in Florida. Should we talk about what spring break is?
Well, spring break is one of those things that I think everyone knows what spring break is, even if... I mean, for us here, it's Easter holidays, which isn't quite...
No one goes,
not really.
Easter holidays.
Easter holidays, if people went down to Brighton and got absolutely leathered for...
Exactly.
Like 4 weeks.
I mean, it's basically people going to Florida and getting drunk and having sex.
And behaving badly.
Yeah, but there's just something very different about Florida and Brighton. But no, it's yeah, it's not really about spring break. It's about these girls who go on spring break, and then it gets a lot darker and a lot weirder. There's lots of drugs and sex and all that sort of nonsense, and then they meet this gangster rapper who's played amazingly by James Franco, who sort of takes him under his wing, and it gets ridiculous.
It does get a little bit ridiculous, doesn't it, David? And it's interesting as well when you look at the casting, because, you know, as Alex mentions, you've got James Franco in a role which is very different from, well, certainly from what he's doing in the other film he's got out at the moment, Oz, the Great and Powerful. This is very, very different. And he's got a couple of old Disney Channel starlets that are, yeah, in slightly different roles, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I think that this might be James Franco's greatest performance.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, I think he
even better than when he hosted the Oscars.
Is, well, on a, it almost draws on that, I think, on the kind of weirdness and eccentricity. He plays this kind of faux mobster gangster rapper called Alien, who amasses all this stuff. I don't want to use the term that he calls it on the radio. And it's this really bizarre performance that's at once incredibly seedy and leery, but also rather charming at the same time. And he's a tough character to read. And yeah, as you say, at the same time, the four girls who are the spring breakers are all alumni of the Disney Channel. And it all feeds into this idea of corrupting youth and taking these clean cut, apple cheeked young teen idols and, you know, putting them through the sort of mill of American debauchery. And
Alex, one of the lines when these blonde girlies are about to do their first heist is, you know, when they try and muster up enough courage, is pretend you're in a video game. Mm. I mean, I think stylistically, when I've read all the critics, I think stylistically it's kind of been wowing people. Does it have a bit of the visual iconography of a video game?
Yeah, and the logic and the sense. I mean, but it's supposed to be. I mean, the film, for me, its strengths are in the experience. It's not really what it's about. I mean, people have been talking for weeks and weeks about the politics of it and the themes. And it's really, I think Harmony Korine is having a laugh. It is layered, and I think you can take from it what you want. But I think at the ultimately, it's a film about feeling and what it does to you and what you get out of it on a very superficial level. And you can discuss it and analyse it as much as you want. But for me, it's unlike any other film I've ever seen, and the music and the visuals are incredible.
It's taken Harmony Korine a while to get to this stage, though, hasn't it, David? In that, you know, he burst onto the scene writing Kids, which, you know, shocked lots of people almost 20 years ago now. And yet, in fact, it is 20 years ago now, I think. And yet, you know, as Alex said, everything he's done since then has been pretty ropey. I mean, this is his most commercial and his most interesting film to date, isn't it?
Well, I would say so, yeah. I mean, I'm a big fan of his directorial debut, which is called a film called Gummo from 1997, I believe. And one of the things that I think has that he's known for and which he presents in all of his films is he finds this kind of weird poetry in these like fractured lives, debauchery. And in Spring Breakers, in the same way, he finds this poetry in debauchery, in the way he films it, in the way he soundtracks it, in the way he edits it. I think one of the things he's known for is he lets his camera roll. He films lots of scenes. He lets things roll. He tries to capture these little accidental moments.
And he did this during, I mean, this was filmed during an actual spring break, wasn't it? In Florida, with actual parties going on all around it, which he just sort of dumped his actors in.
And I think he's one of these directors who, I think the term is finding the film in the edit. So, you know, he takes all the film footage and you know, sculpts, basically.
And does it work? Do you think it works?
I think it works brilliantly, this film. I mean, you say that the sort of stylistic influences suggested as computer games. I think one of the things he's also said is it's influenced by rap videos. And I think, you know, just by looking, there's a character in the film played by trap rapper Gucci Mane. If you just YouTube some of his videos, you can actually see that he's sort of
Don't do it, kids.
Little bits from those videos, just little moments. You know, there's a shot of a guy just doing donuts in the street on a quad bike, and you know that's just part. He's really sort of captured the reality of that kind of scene amazingly well, I think.
Well, from rappers to classical music.
Indeed. But just before we move on, though, I just want to just in praise of Roger Ebert, who died this week, one of the greatest film critics America's ever known. He always did thumbs up and thumbs down. Now, obviously, this doesn't work quite so well on radio, but for each film, thumbs up or thumbs down. David?
Oh, this would be thumbs up for me.
Alex?
Two thumbs up. I saw it twice. I can't wait to see it again.
Brilliant. Okay, good. There we are. Gillian, carry on.
I love that idea for radio.
It doesn't really work.
We have
work,
to do that
it?
More. No, it does. We've got to do it more for the review.
What sort of noise would a thumbs up
slide
thing?
Whistle or something?
Yeah, wolf whistles.
Yeah, you can do a sort of, as you gradually sort of put your thumbs up, sort of, ooh, or, ooh. Anyway, there we are. Let's move on to the next one, Gillian.
I'll bring my slide whistle next time.
Well, for the next film, we're going to have a listen to it first. This is a late quartet, so we're going to first have a listen and then we'll set the film up.
Do you really love me, or am I just convenient?
What is it that you want? What is it that you want me to tell you?
What are you afraid of? Unleash your passion.
What are we supposed to do? Stop? Or struggle to continuously adjust to each other up to the end, even if we are out of tune? I don't know.
There we go. An excerpt from A Late Quartet. Now, Alex, I'm going to make you work again. Two films really about sort of... aging is perhaps unfair, but mature musicians called quartet. One, Dustin Hoffman. This is a very different film. What's the difference? What's this one set out to do?
That's an interesting question. I tell you, that clip makes it sound very exciting, which it's not. It's about a famous quartet who was sort of going off the rails a little bit. There's been tensions within their relationships for years. They're led by Christopher Walken, who's got early stages of Parkinson's, and he says this is going to be the last thing they do together. And then it just there's lots of bashing heads, and people start having sex with people they shouldn't, and people start shouting a lot, and that's basically it.
And there's a bit of Beethoven as well. David, it's... You look at this, you think, well, you know, I must like this. It's got Philip Seymour Hoffman. He's brilliant. He's never bad. It's got Christopher Walken. Christopher Walken does do some very bad films, but still, he's great. Oh, it's got Catherine Keener. It's going to be really good. And yet...
Yeah, there is this kind of major confluence of talent there. And, you know, it's a kind of collection of America's greatest supporting actors in a single film, I think. And but yeah, there's just something about it. I think it's sort of sold short by the material, and I think maybe the sort of vague pretensions of director Yaron Zilberman.
This is his first feature film that he's directed,
yeah.
Isn't it? Yeah. And he did documentaries before?
I believe so, yeah. I don't know, the way it's filmed and the acting is all, it's as you've heard in the clip, it's all kind of ramped up and slightly hysterical, and actually comes across more of a soap opera. I mean, a very classy soap opera. But
It felt to me more like it really should be a play. It's got elements of a stage play in that it's got a performance as well with the quartet. It's got these sort of, you know, characters talking and not much doing.
I think it's a shame because it's not completely dislikable, and they are great in it. And Christopher Walken, I would single out as being fantastic in it, because this is one of the straightest roles he's played for a long time. He's not doing all his tics, and he's not doing his noises and flapping around. And you really get a sense of the fact that he's a brilliant, brilliant actor in it. I really liked him in it. And, you know, it is a great cast, and you can't sort of say that anyone's doing anything terribly wrong. It's just, you know, the thing about it is the people in it, these characters, they're the sort of people that Woody Allen would lay into in his 70s and 80s films. They're sort of, you know, they're just annoying, and their problems are not interesting.
But there's no Woody Allen there to do that.
Exactly.
I do like the premise, though, of a kind of metaphor, because it sets out that they're going to be playing the Beethoven's Opus 131, which is one of the most difficult things to play because it's 40 minutes long, and musicians don't have the time to retune their instruments, and so in the process of the 40 minutes, they have to learn how to improvise if it's not going to end in disaster. And apparently each of the seven movements in this opus reflects the seven stages of man. So it is quite a clever sort of underlying
I'm not sure. I kind of found the idea of the detuning of the instruments and the fact that the music changes as you're playing it kind of interesting, and you know, parallels with the idea of Walken's character getting Parkinson's and sort of slowly deteriorating beyond his control. But at this, I don't think it's a neat idea, and but it's not enough to really carry an entire drama. And there's too much shrieking and following people around shopping malls to really make it impact.
You want to like it, but by the end you're just tired of them all.
Okay, well let's before we move on from this, Ebert style, thumbs, David.
Can you do thumbs neither way, ambivalent.
Fine. Ambivalent thumbs. Ambivalent thumbs from David. From Alex.
Droopy thumb.
Droopy thumb from Alex. There we are. Right, we're going to move on to our third film. This is Thursday Till Sunday.
Yo te voy a decir cuando tienes que frenar. ¡Frena!
No me gusta cuando se ve así.
¿Cómo?
Redondo.
David, you're rather a fan of this film, aren't you? Explain to us what it's all about.
Well, it's a debut movie by a young Chilean director called Domingo Sotomayor. I've seen it described somewhere as like an existential Little Miss Sunshine, suggesting that it's basically about...
It's a road trip.
Yeah, it's a road trip movie. And it's definitely one of those road trip movies where it's more about the journey than the destination. It's all told from the perspective of two young sort of preteen children, one girl and one boy, who are sort of cooped up in the back of the car. And as they're sort of traveling down the road, going from Santiago to the coast, and you kind of get inklings that all is not well with their parents in the front seats, and that there is, that maybe the parents' relationship isn't as close as you maybe once suspected. And it's a really great movie about the experience of being in a car for a long journey, being cooped up.
Is it possible to make a great movie about being in the back of a car?
I hated this film. It's exactly what I hated about it. So claustrophobic and so irritating. I wanted them to leave the kids behind. It's terrible.
Oh, dear.
You would have preferred to have seen the film about the parents in the front seats.
Yeah. Well, no. I wanted the kids to leave them behind as well. It was four characters you had no interest in at all. At least, Little Miss Sunshine, there were quirky characters and there was humour. This is Little Miss Sunshine without the humour. It was humourless.
I don't know quite what happened to David's face there. Sort of convulsion.
I didn't
He's
expect
hit
that.
Me.
But there's this...
ambushed.
Part of the thing I also really liked about it, I mean, is that as much as it's about this family in a car traveling and their story and their kind of sort of decline, did you not enjoy this whole sort of backdrop? And there's almost kind of Hitchcockian ominous portents in the background. These things happening.
I love the opening. I agree. I think the opening sequence is amazing. And then throughout, you think something bad's going to happen.
But
nothing happens.
No, that's the film. that's what's so great about it. You're kept in this state of high alert for the entire film, waiting for something terrible to happen.
But
it's kind of left for you to decide in the end that this family might be kind of falling apart, and which is a kind of tragedy in itself. But I just think this is an extraordinary film.
Director to decide for you,
David. Is there? I mean, when you look at Chilean film more generally, I mean, is there? Because not much gets shown outside of Latin America. Mm. I mean, should we be, this one aside for Gillian's sake, but should we be watching more Chilean films?
Well, I mean, I don't think I can comment specifically on Chilean films, but this has got more of a general, I'd say more of a general Latin American vibe. There's specifically some directors, an Argentine director called Lucrecia Martel, who did a film called The Headless Woman, which this is very similar, and I believe Sotomayor is very sort of fond of her work, and There's another director called Lisandro Alonso who also does very similar films about people sort of trudging through landscapes. You're not sure what's going to happen. You're not sure why they're doing it, where they're going, what, you know, what the purpose
is. These films sound perfect, Virginia.
they're very kind of existential journeys and very, super intense. And it kind of this movie is very much kind of ripped from that.
I'm really looking forward to the thumbs on this now. Thursday till Sunday. David, thumbs for you.
Oh, this would be a double thumbs for me.
Double thumbs. Gillian?
Little finger down.
Little finger down. Little finger down. Blimey. God, that's just rude. I think that's all we've got
time for. I
think
you need to watch
for.
It again.
Please don't.
I don't think she's going to do it. You've got a flight coming up, haven't you? You need to sleep on the flight,
yeah,
maybe.
Exactly.
Anyway, we're going to leave it there. Alex Godfrey and David Jenkins, thank you both very
thank
much
you.
Indeed. Headlines, I guess, is Spring Breakers?
Yeah, do it. Yes, and if you're... feeling crazy Thursday till Sunday.
Okay.
It's Cine Lumiere, I believe.
Alex and David, thank you very much. There's more to come after this short break. We'll be hopping on our private cultural jet around the world with Nelly Gocheva.
If we use, dear listeners, the metaphor of Monocle 24 as an online radio amusement park, then Culture with me, Robert Bound, is the roller coaster.
We are finally on the train, on the sexy contemporary art train.
Scaling the heights of artistic endeavour to look out across a picturesque international landscape dotted with galleries, live music venues, outdoor screenings of wonderful movies being scrutinised and applauded by appreciative audiences. Marvel at the view. Strap yourself in. Scream, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to go faster. We're just one metaphor away from a meltdown. On the latest edition, we dress up as the next Harry Potter to attend Bologna's Children's Book Fair, go largely AWOL at a festival in Mexico, and find out why there's a big red shed on London's South Bank.
It has been, I think, a real bolt of energy and excitement throughout the whole of the organisation, the fact that we've got this temporary chance just to sort of let collective hair down a little and do something different.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
You are listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Gillian Tobias, and Steve Bloomfield. And it is now that time of the show when we cross over to Associate Editor Nelly Gocheva to hear about some cultural highlights happening this weekend around the world.
Tokyo's University of the Arts is hosting a new exhibition entitled Fendi, Another Kind of Art. The famed fashion house takes us on a retrospective journey of traditional Italian design and craftsmanship. On display is a collection of sketches alongside the brand's most iconic designs from the 70s onwards. The show is on until the 29th of April. The 9th edition of the Sao Paulo International Art Fair is a must-see if you happen to be in the city. The fair welcomes about 150 galleries from around the world. The focus, however, is on Brazilian art, with most of the collectors and dealers coming from the country. Local highlights include Sao Paulo's galleries Vermelho and Eduardo Fernandes and Galleria Sergio Gonçalves from Rio de Janeiro. For more information, go to sp-arte.com. In Paris, Gallery Nielsen et Chiglien welcomes an exhibit by New York-based Vincent William Gagliostro. The artist uses a combination of clashing colors and conflicting materials, from Bible paper to wood, for his flamboyant works. The show is on until the 11th of May. In London, the Simon Lee Gallery hosts the work of German visual artist Hans-Peter Feldmann. In a variety of nudes, seascapes and installations, the current exhibition follows Feldman's successful shows at the Serpentine Gallery in London last year. The exhibition is on until the 8th of May. And finally, for all you jazz lovers out there, we suggest Eliane Elias' new album, I Thought About You, a tribute to Chet Baker. Known for her distinctive, sensual voice and her Brazilian roots, the Sao Paulo-born singer-songwriter delivers impressive instrumental jazz and classical tunes. Now let's hear Embraceable You. For Monocle, I'm Nelly Gotcheva.
Embrace me, my sweet, embraceable you. Embrace me, my irreplaceable you. Just one look at you, my heart grows tipsy in me. You and you alone bring out the gypsy in me.
That was Embraceable You by Eliana Elias, ending that report there by Nelly Gotcheva. And staying on the topic of Latin American music, it's time now for our weekly music section of the show. And I'm excited to reveal that this week's guest is a rather unusual one.
Yes, and that's because if you say the name Martin Morales to residents of London, they would likely think of Ceviche, his highly successful Peruvian restaurant, but he's also the founder of Tiger's Milk Records, a label which is re-releasing modern Peruvian music.
The label says that, like the marinated fish dish for ceviche, music has always been a mainstay of Peru's cultural life. And so here to tell us more is Martin. Martin, welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
And first of all, thank you for bringing in these wonderful, I was going to say gifts, but you're going to take them back,
items.
Aren't you? These sort of incredible collector's items of record cleaners.
That's right, yeah. From late 60s, early 70s, from the record labels in Lima, in Peru. And I just thought they'd be good to look at. I'm sorry you can't see them on the radio.
I mean, I'd like to show them to our creative director, Richard Spencer Powell, because the graphics are incredible on them. They're almost like, old vintage sort of, I don't know, shoe shine kits.
That's right.
Beautiful retro graphics on them. They're wonderful.
Well, that's the beautiful thing about old records and old things. I'm a collector at heart. Collect dishes, collect music, collect vinyl. And this is part of all that heritage.
Now, you started as a DJ. Is that right?
Yeah, as a DJ and creating events with food and music, I used to have a night in Leeds and another night in Bath that I used to curate and create called the Global Kitchen, where I would DJ and cook at the same time and call myself DJ Chef.
So how do you DJ and cook at the same time?
You've got a cooker on one side and a couple of 12-10 Technics on the other.
I think we have to bring you here for our summer fair.
it would be a pleasure.
Do you still do that?
No, not anymore.
Just bring back DJ Chef.
But there could be a comeback. Okay. That would be a big day, I hope.
I think, the campaign to bring back DJ Chef starts right here.
DJ Chef, we want, no.
It's the Monaco Summer Fair. It's June the 16th.
Okay.
I mean, just mark that date in your diary.
There you go.
Maybe you should come to do it.
We can do some cold cooking of ceviche. Not so exciting.
Okay, well, fair enough. I'm sure we can at least do that. How did you then move from doing that to then deciding? I mean, were you sort of torn between which direction you wanted to go in, food or music?
No, I mean, we should be doing things that we love in life, and I've always loved music. I've loved food. I love all types of arts and culture. So I love cinema and film, and hey, one day we might work there as well. But my career took me from DJing at the weekends, which was really a hobby, to working in the daytime and having an executive job in a music company, first working at EMI, than working with iTunes, than working with Disney and other sort of independent music companies. But just saying, look, I'd love to do this. I love the restaurant sector, hospitality. I love serving food. And creating club events was part of that. It's creating experiences. So this was an absolute natural step two or three years ago to say, stop talking about it, get on with it and create something. And that's where ceviche came from.
The brilliant thing with food and creating food, it's kind of like the flip side of the record where, the ingredients are your notes and you have something there. You're literally like composing something, but with, sort of real ingredients.
Absolutely. And it is a performance all the time. You are, when you open a restaurant, in a day, for example, we open between 12 and 12 midday and close at 12 midnight. And it's a performance. You have to get it right. And all the players, I feel like an orchestra director, all the players have to play to the same tune and the same beats and actually get it to be a beautiful piece of music that's working harmoniously.
Let's talk about the record later, and then we've got two or three tracks that we're going to play from it. Tiger's Milk Records. It's you're specifically looking for old Peruvian tracks that you're hoping to re-release to a different audience.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is. I've been a collector of vinyl since I was 15 years old. I always go back to Peru and just scour the record shops and sort of collectors and find collectors, you know, guys that are in the depths of Lima or other cities, you know, just hiding their record collections away from the world and don't think that their vinyl is worth anything. To me, it is. To many people, it isn't. But I love old music, vintage music. So I thought, why not start re-releasing some of this, some of it that's hard to find. Some people might not, you know, not know much about it, but let's do that. But also work with new artists that we love. So that's sort of coming up in the future.
Well, we're going to hear, we're going to have a sample, a taster of some of the music. I think this first track, actually, I should have you pronounce it because I'm looking at all these. Can you introduce that first one there? I can't pronounce it.
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah, that's
so
one.
It's Paco Zambrano y su combo, and the track is called Mezcalina.
Paco Zambrano y su combo there with Mezcalina. Tell us, Martin, about Paco Zambrano. Who is he?
Paco was a percussionist who created a band in the mid-60s. And he also played with some of the Peruvian greats of the time, Ivan Cruz and Bartola. And this track comes from all that kind of funk, Latin, slightly psychedelic scene that was emerging at the time. Mezcalina refers to an Inca god called Yahuahuasca.
Okay.
And also a potent brew that he took. it's a real, really, really funky track. It originally comes from a funk band from Peru called Traffic Sound, which was really big now at the time, and people are collecting them quite a lot. But no one really knows about this track. That's why we thought we'd put it out.
And how did you come across it yourself?
Just scouring through record shops and also through our co-founder of Tiger's Milk Records, Duncan Ballantyne, who's just a real train spotter like I am. So we, you know, I think he actually found this one, and you know, it's just a wonderful funky track, and a lot of kind of DJs that are into jazz and Latin and funk are really into it.
I mean, music is so important to so many different countries in South America. What would you say is different about the sound coming out of Peru?
There's different influences. I mean, we've got the Amazon and we've got the Andes, and so many things happened through the years that were coming from the folkloric roots from there, and a lot of people migrated from those areas to the city. That's when those clashes of mixtures and fusions happened. For example, I mean, we'll hear the next track, but another track that we worked with is called La Cumbia del Pacurro, but it's really a chicha track, and chicha is a sound that really comes from that clash between the Andes and the tropical sound of the coast.
Well, let's hear that track. It's La Cumbia del Pacuro, and it's by Juaneca y su combo.
Thank you.
Juaneco y Socombo there with La Cumbia del Pacuro. Now, Martin, all these tracks are released in rather special sort of forms of vinyl, aren't they? Explain a bit more.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're vinyl lovers. We're lovers of digital music as well. So we're trying to release everything in its original format. You know,
okay.
Both these tracks were never released digitally. Mm. They were only released in the first test pressing, the first pressing on vinyl. So let's do that again. Let's create these beautiful products that are beautifully designed and sound great and take you back to the moment. You can hear all that kind of fuzziness, all that kind of feedback, all those kind of sounds in the background.
I mean, that felt like it was recorded in the Amazon.
Yeah, exactly. And you can almost smell the vibes and the water and the atmosphere there. So yeah, that's what we want to do.
I love the very simple packaging. It looks like a real record cover, white with your Tiger's Milk logo on it. Why Tiger's Milk?
Milk is the marinade we use to create our ceviches, and we just thought it was a funky name to call a record label because, you know, Tiger's Milk itself is made from lime juice, chilies, and it's just zesty and fresh, and that's kind of the only link, really.
So both those tracks that we've just played are on this. This piece of vinyl, 7-inch, I've got in my hand here. We're going to play one more as well, which is Canaco y el Tigre, with a very English title, Exorcist Love Song. At Canaco y el Tigre there with Exorcist Love Song. Martin, just before you go, do you think there's a moment coming for Peru and its music and its food? Over the last few years, there's been more people talking about it in a way that, you know, obviously Brazil always gets the limelight, Argentina as well. Is Peru's moment coming?
If you dig deep, you'll find some beautiful things. You can find them all over the world, but certainly Peru, we've been brewing our beautiful creativity, gastronomy, music for a long time. And so it deserves to be discovered. I'm here to help in that process. I'm here to champion that, and that's what my mission is. And yes, I think, people are talking about the fashions coming out of Peru. People have obviously been traveling there for a long time, and now it's super cool to go there again. The gastronomy scene has just exploded around the world. Mm. We're leading it, we hope, we think, in London. And on the music side, gosh, there's so much talent right now, and there's so much beautiful music from the past. So go out and check it.
We will indeed. Martin Morales, founder of Ceviche. If you're in London, do go down there. And Tiger's Milk Records, if you're anywhere, you can pick that up. Thank you so much for joining us today on The Review, and good luck with the label as it moves forwards. You're listening to Review on Monocle 24.
Time now to cross to a city around the world to hear what's happening over there this weekend and in the coming days. Today we're headed to Istanbul, and Monocle correspondent Joseph Dana is here to guide us through it.
Spring is in the air, and Istanbul is flexing its cultural muscles. From film festivals to art openings, the city is broadcasting its well-deserved pedigree as a powerhouse of regional culture on the banks of the Bosphorus. The Istanbul Film Festival, Turkey's premier cinema event, enters its last week with a diverse schedule of international and Turkish films on offer. Renowned Mexican director Carlos Rigades will be in town for a retrospective of his work and a masterclass at the Perry Museum on the 9th of April. Be sure to catch Asle Özge's outstanding ode to Istanbul and hit among festival goers, Lifelong. The film is screening throughout the week.
Bu erkekler kendilerini nasıl bulunmaz Hint kumaşı sanıyorlar yani.
If dark movie theaters have you pining for spring weather, stroll down to the Topani Art Walk on Sunday afternoon. Forming the backbone of this emerging district on the European side, a mix of contemporary art galleries and museums will open their doors, creating the perfect atmosphere to sample Istanbul's understated art scene. Be sure to drop by the Depot Gallery for Mathieu Poisson's latest collection of drawings, exploring the little-known and long-forgotten corners of the city. A fixture of New York's East Village, Nublu Lounge has a new location in Karaköy, on the European side of Istanbul. The creation of Olhan Ersahin, a saxophonist and keyboard player, Nublu Lounge has a reputation as an incubator of musical talent. This week, Austrian ensemble Jinja will join Belgian group Absent Minded for a series of performances which will surely highlight local sounds. For Monocle, in Istanbul, I'm Joseph Dana.
Angels by Wax Poetic, the project associated with the Nublu Lounge, Joseph Dana mentioned there. You're listening to Review on Monocle 24. We'll be staying in Turkey next, but this time we'll be talking literature. Stay tuned.
The beautifully turned out April issue of Monocle includes our new spring style directory, which takes a look at the best retail projects around the globe, the new shopping neighbourhoods, why Jakarta is on the fashion map, and how the Swiss make the watch world tick. We also take a visit to Tokyo Hands, the famous Japanese store where you can buy everything you didn't know you needed. And we have lots more in this issue too.
In the affairs section, we head to the Turkey-Syria border to discover what NATO is and isn't doing in Syria. We visit the largest Finnish community outside the Nordic region. It's in Canada. And we also meet a woman you might remember, Imelda Marcos, and her shoe collection.
In the business section, we take a sniff at the scent industry. We send our Paris correspondent south to Grasse to find out how the Provençal town is becoming a hub for high-tech innovation. And we introduce a new section, Master and Apprentice. In the first instalment, we profile a man who started tailoring aged 11.
In culture, we ask how you renovate and rebrand one of the world's greatest museums. We visit Amsterdam's Istanbul Rijksmuseum to see what a 10-year sabbatical teaches you. We also investigate high turnover tales in the world of the art postcard and just for a minute give in to the allure of the average, courtesy of our Culture Ed's column.
The April issue of Monocle is on newsstands now, or treat yourself to a subscription. Visit monocle.com now to find out how to join the club.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Review with me, Gillian Tobias, and Steve Bloomfield.
And we're finishing the show today by cracking open the spine on a couple of new titles to come out of Turkey and Romania. They've been published by London-based imprint Istros, which specialises in translating works from that part of the world and bringing them to an English-speaking readership.
And we're delighted to welcome back Istros director Susan Curtis-Kajakovic into the studio to tell us about these new titles and to look ahead to the London Book Fair, where they'll be running Croatia's national stand. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you very much.
Just back.
Yes, just back from Croatia, fresh off the plane. That's right.
And did you come with a suitcase full of new writers?
I came with a
suitcase full of magazines for the Croatian stand at the London Book Fair, because the Croatian Writers Association have very fortuitously just published a magazine dedicated to contemporary Croatian literature in English translation. So it gives a wonderful overview of what's going on there, excerpts from various writers, all translated into English already, interview with me and with various other editors from the region. So,
and when you look at the state of Croatian literature at the moment, I mean, how does it compare to elsewhere within the Balkans? What makes Croatian literature in particular stand out?
Croatia's in quite an exciting position at the moment. in terms of, you know, economically and, well, not economically perhaps, but in terms of the fact that it's joining the EU. So it will be joining the EU on the 1st of July. It will be the newest member. So that's something to look forward to. And on the literary front, obviously, we're having this stand at the London Book Fair. That's the first time that Croatia's ever had a stand. And I think I'm right in saying that it's the first time that any republic from ex-Yugoslavia has had a stand at the book fair. So it's quite a good big deal. And it's all part of this festival called Welcome Croatia, which is leading up to the EU integration. And a couple of exciting things that are happening at the moment for them is that two of their writers are up for very big UK awards. There's Josip Novaković, who's a Croatian writer who's lived in North America for quite some years. And he's up for the Man Booker International Award, which is a Lifetime Achievement Award. And then there's Dasha Dundic, whose book Trieste was published by Maclehose Press last year, I believe. And that's on the long list for the Independent Foreign Fiction Prize.
I suppose one of the problems with Croatian literature going beyond its borders is that so many of the good writers aren't yet translated in the English yes. language. So for those of us who haven't had the opportunity to read some interesting writing from Croatia, what are some of the themes and stories, and what are the good writers writing about? What makes them special?
What makes them special? Okay, well, I mean, one of the themes, of course, is always this kind of transition that they've been through, that they've had a lot of big events happening to them in the last 20 years. They went from communism to democracy, to capitalism. They had a war with the neighbours. They've been trying to build the country, the nation, economically and socially since then. And so there are a lot of things that they've experienced that we have no idea of. I think that's very interesting for people. Although I don't choose titles which are, you know, particularly focused on the war or that period, because it's might be a bit of a cliche. I tend to look for those that deal with common human themes, which everyone can understand. But I think that's interesting. I think the fact that that goes for the whole region. A lot of writers there, because it's such a small market, they can't live from their novels or their poetry. And so they do other jobs as well. A lot of them do journalism. But because of that, they're not, you know, forced to write by market forces. Mm-hmm. They write what they want, you know, and they write what they believe in. And I think that can be very fresh and interesting for readers here.
Let's move a little bit further east to Turkey.
Okay.
Some of the novels you've been talking about. There's a new Turkish novella, The Aziz Bey Incident. Mm-hmm. Tell us all about that.
Okay, so this comes from a very respected Turkish writer, Ayfer Tunç. Who's been around for, I think she's been writing for the last 30 years. She's very well known in Turkey. And I think I'm writing saying that this will be her first work published in England, in the UK.
Okay.
Because Turkey is the focus country, everything's at the London Book Fair this year. So Croatia has its first stand, and Turkey is the focus country. So the Ministry of Culture, I think, made a huge effort to bring over a lot of writers, contemporary writers, ones that have been translated and ones which want to be translated. Ayfer Tunç will be here to promote her book. So we have a launch not only at the book fair, but also at Belgravia Books in Victoria on Monday, April the 15th. So anybody in that area is welcome to come along. I think that would be very nice. It's a novella, and it follows the story of a local Istanbul musician and his whole life, looking back from his old age back to his youth. And it's very melancholic. It contains lots of local atmosphere and colour. Of course, you get the whole musical scene of Istanbul, the traditional musical scene. And it's rather beautiful. And comes also in this edition with a couple of short stories, Ayfer's short stories, which follow on from that. And again, I think that she's quite interested in those people who kind of slip outside the mainstream of society for whatever reason.
She started as a journalist herself.
That's
a very
right.
respected
yes.
one. Do you find in the writing of this book that the language and the way she writes it comes from, you know, the discipline of being a journalist, or again, is that the flip
side? The discipline of being a journalist.
Steve.
A bit of an oxymoron. Well, of course, because the way she describes the local colour is very visual, right? So I suppose in that way that she sets the scene, perhaps you could notice the journalism part of it. Otherwise, I wouldn't say it interferes, no. It's quite poetic. It's quite gentle, yeah.
Let's move on to another novel, this one from Romania, called Sun Alley. Tell us about this.
Sun Alley. Yes, Sun Alley came to me. It was recommended by my translator because I don't actually speak Romanian, so I had to take this on trust. Whereas with the Turkish book, I already had a translation to look at. This one I didn't. Had a small excerpt. I very much like the idea for the story because it's set... in Romania of the 1980s, I think. Not that that's important, because in fact there's not much about Romania or Ceausescu or any of those things you might expect.
But is it sort of in the background, or is it? It's worth knowing it's in the background.
It doesn't really matter. No, it doesn't really matter. In actual fact, because it's from the viewpoint of a 12-year-old boy, and you know, for children, their world is their world, right? Politics don't matter. And I think that she must have grown up at that time as well. So she knows very well that they have their whole own universe. So the whole situation of Romania is not really important at the time. It's really that boy's vision of the world and his absolute adoration of his neighbour, Emmy.
And is there a new crop of writers coming out of Romania at this moment in time? Is it a good time for writers?
I would like to say that Romania has always had a good crop of writers. They have a great respect in their culture for writing and poetry. And in fact, when you're there and you watch the television, they often ask a poet to come on and give their opinion or a writer to come on.
Good morning.
They really have a very great respect for the intellectuals in Romania. So I'd like to say that they've always had a good... And they also, every year at London Book Fair, have a wonderful stand, which they design themselves and have lots of people coming over. And Cecilia's coming as well, so I'm going to be pretty busy this year. She'll be promoting her book there, and it's a very, very beautiful book, and I think that people very much like this idea of going back to their childhood and remembering how it was for them and their first love and things. But it's much more complicated than that. It's very lyrical, it's very magical.
You mentioned that this came as a suggestion from your translator.
Yes.
How do you go about choosing the books that you're going to go forward with and going to publication with? Because there's obviously huge amounts out there. Are there sort of normal ways of doing it, or do they come through in sort of rather sort of curious ways at times?
Well, sometimes it's serendipity. It is, actually, I must say. This particular translator is a great friend of mine. I've known her for about 20 years, so obviously there's a lot of trust there. But usually how it happens is that I choose prize winners, people who have won big local regional prizes.
And does that also mean it helps sell it here? Because you can say, look, they won this big prize in Romania or in Hungary or elsewhere.
Well, I'd like to think it does. But I think if I put things like Jutarnyi List Award for Best Novel, I think
that's not quite like the Booker.
Yes. Most people really don't know what that is. The only one that could mean something to them is perhaps the European Prize for Literature. I have published two prize winners from the European Prize for Literature. And at least that's something that people are...
But it might help booksellers realise.
It might,
this is a
yes. I mean, I always say it, and I think it does give some kind of stamp of approval. I mean, the other thing that I think is very useful for readers, if they're coming across a new name, an unpronounceable name, as often happens, from a region they haven't experienced before, is to have an endorsement by some writer that they know from here. But of course, that's not always possible if they don't know the writers either. That's the thing about publishing from the Balkans. Yeah,
there is the Frankfurt Book Fair.
Yes.
What about the London Book Fair? Is London important to showcase countries like this?
Well, I think it is. And it's interesting to note that Croatia and a lot of other countries from the region always go to the Frankfurt Book Fair, because Germany has always had this very high number of translated works from that region. They've always had an interest in that region, whereas England hasn't. And so I think that a lot of them haven't perhaps ventured in as much as they could. But as I've proved, and other small publishers have proved, having a translation in English is enormously helpful, not just for readers here, but I get emails from Turkish publishers, Greek publishers, saying, can we have a look at that English translation? Because it gives them a window into, if they don't have a reader who speaks Macedonian, for example, of course, the English translation really helps.
Indeed. Susan Curtis Kojakovic, thank you very much for joining us here on The Review. And we will be looking at the London Book Fair again next week when we welcome Simon Prosser, Publishing Director for Hamish Hamilton and Penguin. into the studio. But for now, I'm afraid that's all we have time for here on The Review. It's goodbye from all of us here at Midori House. The show was produced today by Case Bilboa. It was researched by Fernanda Augusto Pacheco and Annabelle Bly. Our studio manager was Claire Urban.
For those in search of more culture here on Monocle 24 who can't wait till next Saturday, as ever, Robert Bound will be back at 1900 hours on Monday with the latest edition of Culture. Here's what's in store next week.
On the latest edition, we get all busy with the horn section as we host the Hot 8 Brass Band. We visit South America's finest art fair and look at Irish farmers on film. And they, at least, are charming.
We're handing back over to Georgina with the weekend edition next, where you can catch our pick of the week's best Monocle 24 stories, guests and features on The Curator. And of course, don't forget to tune in to the Monocle Weekly, which will be on air on Sunday at midday London time, so this time tomorrow, with Robert Bound and Andrew Tuck. But you've been listening to The Review with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Gillian DeBias. For all of us here, goodbye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.